Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. On November 6th, Election Day, citizens in Colorado and Washington State voted to legalize marijuana for recreational use. If you're over 21, you can now smoke pot legally in those two states. Less than 2 weeks after the election, lawmakers in five other states, including Rhode Island and Maine, said they plan to introduce marijuana legalization bills next year. Indiana's police chief recently called for legalization. Illinois is expected to become the 19th state to legalize medical marijuana. And Arizona recently approved its first medical marijuana collective. The tide is clearly changing. But all of these laws remain in fundamental conflict with federal law. In recent years, the federal DEA has raided medical marijuana dispensaries in California and shut them down. So how will the Obama administration respond? That is the big question. According to a recent report in the New York Times, the administration has been holding high-level meetings since the election to debate the response, and senior White House and DOJ officials are considering plans for legal action against Colorado and Washington that could undermine the voter-approved initiatives. There are also so many questions about what a commercialized and legal market for marijuana will look like. This is brand new territory. And what does this mean for the rest of us, especially those of us living in California, where voters narrowly defeated the pot legalization measure, Proposition 19, in 2010? Joining us to talk about all of these issues today is Jason Plume. He's a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Humboldt State University and a member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. And Jason joins us from Arcata. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. How are you doing?
Great. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Mason Tavert. He's Director of Communications at the Marijuana Policy Project. He co-directed the successful campaign in support of Amendment 64, the initiative to make marijuana legal for adults and regulate it like alcohol in Colorado. Mason is co-founder of Safer Alternatives for Enjoyable Recreation, a Colorado-based nonprofit dedicated to educating the public about the relative harms of marijuana. He's also co-author of the book, Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? And Mason joins us from Denver. Hi, Mason. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. And Norm Stamper is former police chief of Seattle, Washington, and a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He is author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. He says the major police corruption scandals of the last several decades have had their roots in drug enforcement. And Norm joins us from the San Juan Islands in Washington. Hi, Norm. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks very much, Rose. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. So, Mason, you are in Denver, Colorado. Why don't we start off with you? It's amazing to take a look at the changes that we're seeing. Obviously, legalization in Colorado and Washington. Lawmakers in five states say they're planning to introduce legalization bills next year. Again, Illinois is expected to become the 19th state to legalize medical marijuana. Do you think people realize how quickly things are changing?
Yeah, well, I think people are by and large aware that there is a change occurring. Whether they realize how significant it is at this point remains to be seen, but ultimately what it comes down to is that when people talk about marijuana and hear about marijuana, they become more understanding of it and supportive of ending its prohibition. And so we're seeing such a huge spike in the amount of public dialogue taking place in the media, amongst elected officials, amongst people in their homes, that we're really going to see exponential growth here over the course of the next year or so in support for initiatives and legislation like this.
And the New York Times and the Washington Post both had editorials calling for legalization across the country. How significant are these changes, Norm Stamper?
It's hard to imagine them being any more significant. I think many of us involved in drug policy reform over the years have felt that the changes that we're seeing were inevitable. But I think we're all, at least a little, I'll speak for myself, I'm very surprised to see how quickly the American people have embraced an end to marijuana prohibition.
Well, and also what's fascinating to me is when you look at the arrests. So according to the National Organization for Reform for Marijuana Laws, in 1996, there were 2 marijuana arrests per hour in the U.S. Today, there are 86. So 86 arrests every hour. And as soon as these laws passed in Colorado and Washington, prosecutors in both states dismissed hundreds of pending misdemeanor marijuana possession cases just like that overnight. I mean, that's huge because this greatly affects people's lives.
Well, it is huge. And of course, we've seen many lives ruined, in some cases lost, as a result of the war on marijuana. Many, many people throughout the country in jails or prisons, their futures severely affected by a simple possession marijuana arrest. So it's an act of principled leadership, as far as I'm concerned, that these prosecutors in both of our states, Washington and Colorado, are dismissing the cases they have on the books.
And that's Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle, Washington. And Jason Plume, you are a member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. Tell us what exactly you do there, and then also, how do you read all of these changes? What really explains all of this?
Sure. So here at Humboldt State and through HIMR, we're trying to give people a factual understanding of marijuana, marijuana laws, the cultural importance, the social significance, and the economic potential of marijuana through, you know, scientifically based research rather than myth and misnomer that the federal government really has promoted for the past 40 years within their policies and also in their rhetoric. The explanation about the changes in the laws, I agree that, you know, probably would, I didn't think that this much change would come so quickly, but if you look at the different types of laws pertaining to marijuana, incremental change has come through lowest priority laws, legalization, medical marijuana, and also decriminalization, which has been on the books in many states right now, including California, for the most part. So the change, again, has come quickly, but it's also come incrementally. And I think that's the one of the best ways that policy can transpire in America, because though Americans like quick fixes, they don't really react well to quick change. And so that's come through also a reframing, a new understanding of marijuana. Rather than everything about marijuana is criminal, it's been reframed as a personal choice of leisure act or patients' rights to access medicine rather than having no medical potential. So it's well-developed policy. And
I understand, Mason, that a number of activists on the ground in Colorado specifically targeted moms and the Latino community. Talk to us about just what the conversation sounded like in Colorado.
Well, for the last 8 years here in the state, we've been having a very open and frank discussion about marijuana, specifically about its relative safety compared to alcohol. When we started SAFER out here and we ran the initiative in Denver that made Denver the first city to make marijuana legal, it was based entirely on this discussion over marijuana being less harmful. And that was what our campaign was really pushing over the course of the first year and a half or so of the effort once we introduced the initiative back in 2011. And it then evolved as we got closer to the election, once we got people thinking about the fact that marijuana is not as harmful as they've been led to believe for so many years. It is actually less harmful than alcohol. Then we started to really let people know, well, hey, if it is less harmful and we could be generating tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue, then that makes sense. And we could be taking this money and putting it towards legitimate businesses and taking it out of the hands of cartels and gangs. And we could be letting our law enforcement focus on more serious pressing crime. So we really, you know, had that evolution. But the most important part of it is that we addressed marijuana itself and not just the problems of prohibition, but we addressed people's concerns about the actual substance. And as a result, people were far more comfortable when it came time to decide, should we allow adults to use this legally?
And so Colorado Amendment 64 allows for makes legal the personal use, possession, and limited home growing of marijuana for adults 21 years of age and older. The governor signed an executive order to create a task force on the implementation, and the task force will consider and resolve a number of policy, legal, and procedural issues involving various interests and stakeholders to implement a new constitutional amendment. What else do we need to know about this law? And I'm just curious, how have things changed since this law went into effect?
Well, the law only just went into effect this Monday of this week when our governor issued executive orders declaring that the initiative had taken effect and it is now legal for adults who are 21 and older to possess and grow limited amounts of marijuana. And in that alone, we will now see a decrease in upwards of 10,000 arrests for marijuana possession in our state over the course of the next year. Meanwhile, we are also moving forward, as you mentioned, the task force, and our state is essentially just going to move along as if this is going to take place regardless of the federal government. And our state has demonstrated that that's possible with its medical marijuana system. We have had been fortunate enough here in Colorado to have what is currently the only state-regulated medical marijuana system. Some other states are in the process of taking that step. But we've had hundreds of legal marijuana businesses operating throughout the state, and so far it's been largely free of significant federal interference. There's been some dust-ups, but ultimately we've been going about our business, and that's appearing to be the case. We are also seeing a discussion about industrial hemp in our legislature. That's part of the bill as well, and there's certainly a broad amount of support for that. Our legislature actually passed some legislation last year, even prior to this initiative, in which they are going to start doing some testing with regards to the impacts of industrial hemp. So a lot of things are happening.
Wow. And we'll talk about the Obama administration's response in just a couple minutes. We did invite the DEA to join us. They declined, but they did send us a statement. So we'll read that in just a few minutes. And again, that's Mason Tvert. He's Director of Communications at the Marijuana Policy Project. He co-directed the campaign in support of Amendment 64, the initiative to make marijuana legal for adults and regulate it like alcohol in Colorado. It went into effect on Monday, so if you're over 21, you can now legally smoke pot in the state of Colorado, also in the state of Washington. And Washington lawmakers initially outlawed cannabis back in 1923. So for the first time in 89 years, an adult may possess up to 1 ounce of cannabis for their own personal use in private, and they may do it without being in violation of state law. And Norm, what else can you tell us about what's happening in Washington state, and what changes have you seen so far?
Well, probably the first notable change that we saw was a big smoke out at the base of the Seattle Space Center and the Space Needle, and we found the police department issuing a statement to the effect that we're going to leave you alone for now, but please be advised it is unlawful under the new legislation to smoke in public. And that's really part and parcel of a larger campaign toward reducing problems associated with smoking in public places. I'm talking now about smoking tobacco. We know, and full credit to Mason for co-authoring a book that I think has been pivotal in this entire national conversation, and that is that we know that marijuana is safer than alcohol, that it's healthier than tobacco, that deaths and other assorted horrific outcomes associated with drug use, I certainly refer to alcohol and tobacco as drugs, is just a stark contrast between marijuana and these other drugs. So I think what's happened is that people have finally reached that point of their personal and their collective education to understand that the prohibition against this substance has been absurd and harmful.
So you cannot smoke it in public. You have to do it in private.
That's right.
And is that the same in Colorado, Mason?
Correct. It will be illegal still, which it has been, to publicly use, but in the privacy of your home or in a private location, you are allowed to possess and use marijuana as well as grow it.
And if you get stopped for reckless driving, in addition to taking a breathalyzer test, would you have to be tested for marijuana use?
Well, if it's believed that you potentially have marijuana in your system, and obviously just like with alcohol, there's generally needs to be some probable cause. So just, you know, this has been the case for years here in Colorado and every other state. If, you know, it smells like burning marijuana in your car, or clearly your eyes are bloodshot and the reason they pulled you over is because you were swerving, those are reasons why they'd give a breathalyzer to someone. They're also, when it comes to something like smelling like marijuana, that would be a reason to take you in and test you for that. And generally what we see is a need to test levels of THC in blood to determine levels of impairment. And that's a debate that's going on here in Colorado and elsewhere.
I bet. I mean, it's so fascinating because this is all brand new territory. And again, it is now legal to smoke pot in private if you're over 21 in Colorado and Washington. Lawmakers in five other states, including Rhode Island and Maine, said they plan to introduce legalization bills next year. Indiana's police chief is calling for a legalization of marijuana. Illinois is expected to become the 19th state to legalize medical marijuana, and Arizona recently approved its first medical marijuana collective. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about this brand new territory, and things are just moving so quickly. What's your reaction to the new laws in Colorado and Washington? What questions do you have about this? Because so many of these questions are currently being debated. What do you think this means for the rest of us, especially those of us in California, where voters narrowly defeated the pot legalization measure, Prop 19, in 2010? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. How do you think the Obama administration will respond? How do you think they should respond? And then what are your thoughts about how this will be marketed? The Chronicle actually had a fascinating piece yesterday in which they interviewed venture capitalists who said, yeah, we're going to open dispensaries, but we're not going to have dead posters on the wall. We're going to brand this just like Google and Apple. So there's just so much new territory here. What are your thoughts on all of this? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we already have a number of callers on the line. So, first I want to reintroduce our guest. Jason Plume is a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Humboldt State and a member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle, Washington, and author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. And Mason Tvert is with the Marijuana Policy Project. He co-directed the successful campaign in Colorado, Amendment 64, and he's co-author of the book, Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? And let's hear from Mac in Berkeley. Hi, Mac. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for my call. I'm a teacher and have no problems with adult use of marijuana, but one of the side effects, which nobody's been talking about, is the loss of memory that occurs with marijuana, and I really am concerned about young people, you know, using this because it becomes such a prevalent, just a publicly available drug. I think there ought to be extra,
like education?
Some legislation about people that let young people have it.
Okay.
There was an article in the New York Times the other day about how poorly we're doing in our school system compared to other countries. And I think we have a national interest in doing something about that.
Okay, well,
that's my concern.
Thank you. You bring up some fascinating points. First off, Jason, what does the research tell us about how marijuana affects teenagers?
That was for me?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I think all research so far says that short-term memory is affected. There's no doubt about that. It also says that, you know, any kind of substance, moderation is the best. Two, I'm not going to sit here and promote the use of mind-altering substances for minors. At the same time, alcohol, cigarettes are all regulated towards age groups as well. We find that those industries that aren't properly regulated abuse and then attract and get underage people addicted, such as the tobacco industry. So I think this gentleman's concern is very valid. At the same time, most research shows, and most research of this type is coming out of Britain because of the restrictions on American research of marijuana is held all by the federal government, is that, again, short-term memory is affected. But, again, when you stop smoking or you smoke in moderation, that there's no long-term effects. The toxicity level of marijuana is almost impossible to reach. There hasn't been found any genetic defects caused by marijuana as well.
And so, Norm, now that marijuana is legal in Washington State, are people who are concerned about this talking about maybe education outreach to teenagers? And also, do you think there's a need for legislation to make it illegal to give marijuana to teenagers?
That legislation is already on the books, and our new initiative makes clear how severe a violation it is to furnish marijuana to minors. As far as the education is concerned, up to a half a billion dollars a year in new revenue is anticipated as a result of the passage of this initiative. Probably 60% of that money is earmarked for prevention, education, and treatment. There are people who are dependent upon marijuana and whose lives have been negatively affected by their consumption and essentially their abuse of that drug. It's been said over and over, and it bears repeating, and that is that we can become dependent upon many things in our lives, and sometimes it's just really unhealthy. So we've got a system that over the course of the next year we will be refining that will produce not only regulatory controls against furnishing to minors, but will actually help people who've got a problem with that particular substance.
And what sort of conversations are you hearing about these concerns in Colorado, Mason? And how do you think they should be addressed?
Well, you know, like as Norm said, they are being addressed. You know, marijuana has been universally available to high school students for the last several decades, according to our government. Marijuana has been out there. And the real question is, do we actually want to control it as opposed to just leaving it in an underground market where, you know, those selling it aren't asking for ID and there might be other illegal products being sold? So I think that the voters of Colorado recognize this, and that's why we've taken the step we have. And what's really interesting to note is that here in Colorado, where we do have a system of regulated medical marijuana sales, we've actually seen, despite having hundreds of marijuana businesses throughout the state and people talking about, you know, this marijuana boom here, we've seen use amongst high school students over the last few years since that system started go down by 11%, according to our federal government, whereas meanwhile nationwide, where there's absolutely no regulation, we're seeing use go up by about 11%. So it's very clear that regulating this product, even regulating it partially for medical purposes, is having a positive effect when it comes to keeping marijuana out of the hands of teens.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call. Interesting question there and very important one, Mac. Let's go next, before we go to break, to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Yes. I wanted to know what your guest's organization official stand is as to what the, when you say it's less harmful than alcohol, what harm do you actually officially say that it does as an organization? Also, what is your stance on taxation? Because oregano or basil aren't taxed, and you know, it's basically, you know, a herb. So what is the justification for taxing it, especially if it's not particularly harmful?
All right. Well, why don't we take the first question? And Mason, since you wrote this book, Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? Can you talk about health harms from marijuana versus alcohol?
Well, you know, every objective study on marijuana has concluded that it's far less harmful than alcohol. Now, that's not to say it's entirely without harm. You know, as we've been talking about, you know, marijuana does pose some harm, especially to younger people, and that's why we should be in you know, educating people about this. But marijuana is far less toxic. You know, we see about 40,000 deaths in this country each year attributed solely to the use of alcohol. So that's not traffic accidents or people falling off balconies. That's just drinking in and of itself, 40,000, compared to marijuana, where there's been no deaths attributed to it in history. Then meanwhile, we see that alcohol is more addictive. It's also far more likely to contribute to serious social problems, for example, violent crimes, domestic violence, you know, people injuring themselves. These are all very, very highly associated with alcohol use, whereas they've never been found to be associated with marijuana use.
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. And after the break, we'll talk about taxation, and then we'll also talk about the Obama administration's response. Marijuana now legal in 2 states. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a show that depends on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where we can also find links related to today's show. That's where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter as well. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we will have a conversation about media coverage of Army Private Bradley Manning's whistleblower case. We'll also discuss a McClatchy investigation into the federal government's growing use of polygraph screenings, and we'll talk about the political crisis in Egypt. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the rapidly changing landscape of the legalization of marijuana in the United States. On Election Day, citizens in Colorado and Washington State voted to legalize marijuana. If you're over 21, you can now smoke pot in the privacy of your own home. And lawmakers in five states say that they will introduce legalization bills next year, including Rhode Island and Maine. Illinois is expected to become the 19th state to legalize medical marijuana, and Arizona recently approved its first medical marijuana collective. So things are rapidly changing. What questions do you have? What concerns do you have? How do you think this should be regulated? And what does this mean for those of us living in California? We've got full lines, but we'll have one open in just a couple minutes. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Mason Tavert, Director of Communications at the Marijuana Policy Project. He worked on Colorado's Amendment 64. He's co-author of the book, Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? Norm Stamper is former police chief in Seattle, Washington, and member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He is author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. And Jason Plume is lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Humboldt State and a member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. And Jason, before we talk about taxation, is there anything you want to add about the difference between marijuana and alcohol use?
I wanted to talk about potential for abuse in people between ages 18 and 25, and I agree with the other guests, too, in their estimations of how much alcohol is more dangerous than marijuana. Quite often, people like to compare Holland to America when it comes to drug studies. In Holland, where it's been decriminalized in different forms of legalization for years, they've noticed that in their age group between 18 and 25, there's less smoking or use of marijuana in comparison to America, and that's probably because they've taken the myth out of it, for one, and two, it doesn't become such a novelty. So I just wanted to add to that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you did, because just to add to that, there was a great article in the Epoch Times, and I had no idea, but in 2001, Portugal decriminalized all drugs for people 18 and over, and they found that for children from 13 to 15, drug abuse declined by 25%. As 16 to 18 years old, drug use declined by 22%. It cut heroin deaths by 52%. So it looks like it does go down. So that is just fascinating to look at that research.
And education is based on facts rather than, again, just rhetoric.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you again, Harry. And then we also wanted to get to your taxation question. And according to Medical Marijuana Business Daily, legalization in Colorado and Washington could create an estimated $2 billion market. And these are conservative numbers. Norm, can you talk about how this will be taxed? And Harry wanted to know why marijuana is taxed or why it should be taxed.
Well, as presently conceived, we're looking at 25% at the grower level, 25% at the processing level, and 25% at the retail. Those represent excise taxes. They sound extreme, obviously, to those who have not followed the initiative, but they essentially parallel the alcohol industry. And I guess I would say that one of the reasons many people voted for the initiatives in each of our states, and indeed in California in 2010 with Prop 19, is because today's commercial system is not taxed. It is not regulated. You can't regulate something that's illegal. So many voters thought, well, this is a huge boon to the revenue picture of each of these states, and voted for it for that reason. in addition to others as well. So I think most people would say that if we're going to tax tobacco, if we're going to tax alcohol, then we should tax marijuana. There's certainly a school of thought that says this is a plant that grows naturally, in some cases, wildly, and the government has no right to tax it. But obviously, the social and the cultural implications of that have worked their way toward this conclusion that it is appropriate to tax the substance.
And Norm, Mason, what are your thoughts on this in Colorado, and how will this how will it be taxed there?
Well, there will be a state and local sales tax, just like any other product in large parts. Here, our attorney general evaluated medical marijuana and whether it was subject to tax because it is being used for medical purposes, and prescription drugs are not subject to tax. But what they found is that because it is not technically a prescription drug, it is still a Schedule I substance. It's treated more like ginseng, for example. It's an herbal supplement. So there's not really a way to get out of the state and local sales tax. We also have an excise tax proposed that is up to 15% on wholesale sales of marijuana. So that would be between a retail store and a cultivation facility, for example. And the voters approved that and said that there should be this limited tax on that. So, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is that we live in a society where there need to be certain standards in place. There need to be protections in place whenever people are selling products for consumers to consume. I mean, just like when we have vegetables being sold in the grocery store, sure, you could grow tomatoes in your backyard, but if you're going to sell those tomatoes to other people, there needs to be some level of control there, and there needs to be a way to pay for that level of control so that we can ensure that we know if these tomatoes or this are happen to be tainted, we have the ability to track them down and ensure no other people use them. That costs money, so there is a need. It's a trade-off here. I certainly sympathize with and understand the idea of it being a natural product, and that's why we here in Colorado do allow home growing. That wasn't the case in Washington, but if you would prefer to grow it, then you can, just like if you'd prefer to brew your own beer, you can. But by and large, when you're going to go to a store and you're going to buy a product, it needs to be regulated and someone's got to pay for it.
All right. Well, we've got a caller on growing. So let's hear next from Rosie in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call. I own land in southern Humboldt and northern Mendocino. And, you know, it's a there's a lot of growing up there. And originally there was a lot of mom and pop, and they were sort of in harmony with the land. Now there are commercial growers around running diesel generators. They're called diesel dopers, dumping rodenticides in the land, grading illegally. They're worse or as bad as the loggers. And I wonder, you know, when logging isn't bad, if it's sustainable. But this is not sustainable. It's greed, like the gold rush. This problem is not being addressed, and I want to know if marijuana is legalized, what will happen to these greedy pot growers? Northern Mendocino and Humboldt are not the best place to grow pot. They should really be in drier climates. We get a lot of mold, but anyway, that's my question.
Rosie, let me ask you, is this something that the people you know in Mendocino are talking about? And is there any dialogue between people who live there and the commercial growers?
Well, the problem is we've been told we need to get our communities together and work on this ourselves. However, when you have people in a community that are growing, you know, they don't dialogue. As long as you, in my community, as long as you keep to yourself and, you know, don't kill anybody, you know, that's it.
Right.
So we're supposed to take responsibility for this, but, you know, people are not willing to point fingers at their neighbors, because even if they're not commercially growing 1,000 plants or 2,000, they've got 200 or 300 or 400, so...
Well, thank you for the call. And Jason Plume, you're in Arcata, which is about 3 hours north of Mendocino. First off, what does a commercial grower mean in California? Because pot is not legal here.
Right. Let me say this, though.
Sure.
That's a legitimate concern. I think it's all more reason
to either legalize or decriminalize, because, one, zoning considerations have to be thought of. Just as Mason was pointing out about growing tomatoes in large amounts, you'd want a proper agricultural zoning or industrial zoning. Also, proper licensing, which I know Colorado has as well. Lastly, the city of Arcata has passed what they called Measure I, and that taxed inordinate amounts of electrical use to kind of identify houses that could be growers, but also to say that, you know, you're squeezing out the housing market. So that marijuana, legal or not, has to be properly contained. And I think, again, her concern is very legitimate, because it's not just about how to please growers. It's about how to sustain this industry in the comfortability of the community as well, and the environment. And what does it mean to be a grower in this area? You know, I think it carries a lot of economic weight. One estimate shows that one out of every four cash dollars spent in Humboldt County is a grower dollar. And also, you think about merchants that make a lot of money off of the cash that is spent by growers as well. So it means a lot, actually.
And so what would you say to Rosie, just briefly, about her concerns about commercial growers in Mendocino?
Sure. So, again, I know it sounds trite, but to have your community come together, and what that really means is going through your public officials. Because these public officials in Arcata, now look, they've grown up here. They understand that this is what you can call a marijuana community. It's, you know, commonly called the Emerald Triangle area as well. They said, you know, how can we best live with this industry? And so they started to pass ordinances that contained it. They were, at the same time, they were handling federal threats through their city attorney. So I'd say to her that you should not be punished or feel pressure by legalization movement or the industry in general, and that you must go to your public officials to find some balance.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Rosie. We've got a number of really interesting questions and so many emails, so I want to be sure we get through as many as we can. Let's go through a few callers, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Brian in San Francisco. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I'm Brian. I am an associate member of the United Food Commercial Workers Union Medical Cannabis and Hemp Division, and the UFCW is organizing medical cannabis workers in 18 states now. They have union workers in Oaksterdam University in Oakland and close to 100 in Colorado. I just wanted to ask your panelists what they see as the benefits for a safe, a regulated, a taxed industry to, you know, people who don't use medical cannabis or consumer, you know, cannabis. You know, what are the benefits to the soccer moms, the working people, you know, the people who are just, you know, may receive the benefits from the jobs and the revenue that this new green American industry is going to create?
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for calling in. We'll get a response in just a few minutes. Let's go first to Philip in Brisbane. Hi, Philip.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make the point for an earlier caller who was concerned about memory loss and use in juveniles, is that I've been a lifelong user. I personally have not had any problems with memory. However, I do not allow my children to use pot, and they were not permitted to smoke until they were over 18 and it was out of my hand. But and the reason is I don't think that it's good for the developing brain, and I don't think the developing brain should be assaulted by any foreign substances. And that includes pot. And the other point that I would like to make is that in the recent federal raids, the federal government seemed to target Northstone Organics, whose appeal and guarantee is that their pot is 100% organic and toxin-free, free of pesticides. And not only that, they delivered, so the user was free from the obligation to drive to and from the place of procurement. So
all right.
I think that's that warrants a little investigation. They're closed, and I want to know why they're targeted.
Okay.
They're the ones who are playing by the rules.
Well, thank you for calling. And again, we did call the DEA. They refused to come on the show, but we've got a statement from them. And, I mean, they're basically saying pot is still illegal at the federal level, but we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. Let's hear next from Ron in Palo Alto. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
I would like to suggest that the Obama administration could ease this federal problem and move this entire issue forward by simply issuing an executive order to his administration that they will stand down from enforcement activities of the marijuana statutes, except in association with felonies, federal felonies or felonies in the jurisdiction in which they are associated with the use of the marijuana or sale of marijuana. This would also have the effect of an incentive to stop committing felonies when you have marijuana on you or you're using marijuana.
Right. Well, yeah, and again, right when the laws went into effect in Washington and Colorado, prosecutors there basically said that pending misdemeanor marijuana possession cases are now dismissed. I mean, just like that overnight. So why don't we spend a little bit of time talking about how the Obama administration is going to respond to this. So the DEA declined to come on the show today, but they sent us this response. The DEA's enforcement of the Controlled Substances Act remains unchanged. In enacting the act, Congress determined that marijuana is a Schedule I controlled substance. The DOJ is reviewing the ballot initiatives, and we have no additional comment at this time. On December 6th, the New York Times reporter Charlie Savage wrote a piece about how the administration might respond. They've been holding these high-level meetings ever since the election to debate the response, and senior White House and DOJ officials are considering plans for legal action against Colorado and Washington. On the day before the initiative took effect in Washington, Jenny Durkin, the U.S. attorney in Seattle, warned residents that the drug remains illegal. She says, regardless of any change in state law, including the change that will go into effect on December 6th, growing, selling, or possessing any amount of marijuana remains illegal. So, Norm, you're in Washington. Do you think that the administration might take legal action against Colorado and Washington?
I don't know.
I mean, that's
that is the short answer. Everyone else, we're all involved in kind of a guessing game right now. I think it would be a huge mistake for the federal government to move against these two states. Republicans, Democrats, old people, young people, regardless of geography, have all weighed in on this thing in a variety of polls that suggest that the federal government should allow the states, these two states in particular, to operate under a regulated system that the federal government can then monitor as a laboratory. I think everyone in government today understands that this movement forward is inevitable. It will not be reversed. There could be, as Mason put it, dust-ups. There could be some setbacks. But it would be a huge a political and, in my view, moral mistake for the government to intervene in these two states.
And that's Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle, Washington, and a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He says the major police corruption scandals of the last several decades have their roots in drug enforcement. And Mason Tvert is director of communications at the Marijuana Policy Project. He co-directed the successful campaign in support of Colorado's Amendment 64. Mason, what are you hearing in Colorado about how the feds will respond?
Well, you know, their silence up to this point is certainly intriguing. And, you know, as I said earlier in the program, we've had a functioning system of medical marijuana regulation in which we have hundreds of storefronts throughout the state of Colorado where marijuana is being openly sold to qualified medical marijuana patients. And the federal government has largely interfered. So we certainly hope to see that take on it, at least up until the point where this might be more formally resolved. For example, upon passage of the initiative, we saw members of Colorado's congressional delegation, particularly Diana DeGette, a Democrat, and Mike Kaufman, a Republican, two members who had not been very out front on the marijuana issue, immediately come out and say that they were introducing legislation to address this question at the federal level. And then the breaking news today is that Senator Patrick Leahy from, I believe it's Vermont, coming out and saying that he feels that there needs to be a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on this, which he plans on organizing for the upcoming congressional session. So they're obviously taking this very seriously, and hopefully they will arrive at a thoughtful and responsible conclusion in which the states can work with the federal government to have the most responsible policy. I mean, I don't think there's anyone in Colorado, any elected officials and largely citizens who want to see marijuana being trafficked illegally outside of the state. And that is a job for the federal government, is to deal with that type of illegal interstate trafficking. But when it comes to marijuana being produced in Colorado, sold in Colorado, and used by adults in Colorado, that's something the federal government should not be interfering with.
And the bill that you mentioned, House Bill 6606, it's got, not too many supporters, but they're both Democrats and Republicans, and the one California rep is Representative Barbara Lee, who signed on as a co-sponsor. And Jason, again, member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research, what are your thoughts on the Fed's response? Because they did crack down hard in Oakland at Oaksterdam University back in April.
Right, so they seem to showcase their, punitive talents in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and I think they busted Montana dispensaries this year, too, based on what they thought was tax evasion. So politically, on the macro level, there's a few things going on here. One is, when Obama first took over the presidency, his initial statements were that he wanted to reconsider marijuana's legalization or at least medical use and rescheduling. And then the last 2 years, he's really retracted that kind of rhetoric. And I listened to the Marijuana Policy Project's director, Ron Campia, the other day, and he talked to this issue. And he says, you know, we forget that the president has health care, the war on terror, and economic downturn to deal with, that it's almost impossible to keep track totally or keep the reins, tight reins, on all of your bureaucratic agencies, especially one that is led by the Department of Justice, and that he has just let them go and do their thing that they've been doing for the past 15 or 20 years, and that is raiding dispensaries. And also, Obama has backtracked a little bit on how much political capital he'd use towards reconsideration of rescheduling marijuana. I think at this point, with all these states either going medical or legal or looking for alternatives to prohibition, that it would be a very prudent move for the Obama administration to reconsider. But at the same time, they have political face to save. The war on drugs was very, very forceful in the way people stood on illicit substances for years, and that's hard to give up. So I think you're going to see a slow change from the administration. You might see some legal action, but as far as more raids, I would think that's going to be turned down a bit. And there's also a rescheduling petition now at the federal district court level to be considered. So I think things are changing, but at the federal level, it changes even slower than at the states.
We actually have an email from Nancy who says, high-level talks going on right now about weed. Why aren't they having high-level talks about the cost of never-ending war? Wasting all that time on pot, it blows my mind. Thanks for the email, Nancy. We actually have a call on the war on drugs. So let's hear from Deborah in San Francisco. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. So I'm not for marijuana being legal, but I just don't understand how we can legalize it while we have the war on drugs. I mean, we are shutting down marijuana production in Afghanistan, in Mexico, throughout all South and Central America. How can we allow it to happen in the United States as a nation?
Well, can you elaborate on that question?
Well, I mean, I think about we have the war on drugs. The United States government is shutting down marijuana production throughout the world.
Right.
How can it allow to go on in our own soils?
Well,
so I really think this is it's a bigger picture than wanting marijuana to be legal.
Yeah, well, right, and there are major connections between the two. Norm, you're a former police chief of Seattle, Washington. You did a lot of work on the war on drugs. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I think your caller is spot on. The United States is the four-star general in the global war on drugs. But what we're finding is that the U.S. government is being put on notice by countries literally around the world, in Latin America and Europe and the Middle East. What we're hearing is that U.S. drug policy, which has been emulated by countries around the world and certainly has found policy embedded into U.N. law, that it's not working. It's having precisely the opposite effect of what was intended. And that being the case, it's time for some very serious soul searching on the part of the United States Congress and the President, and to look at the horrific damages that have resulted from the war on drugs. We've spent $1 trillion prosecuting it since Nixon famously proclaimed drugs public enemy number one and declared all-out war on them, which is really a war against his own people. We have incarcerated tens of millions of Americans for nonviolent drug offenses. And what do we have to show for it? Drugs are more readily available at lower prices and higher levels of potency than at any other time. So it's a colossal failure, and it's really important, I think, for us to use the example. They may be modest in scope, but of two states whose people have said this war on marijuana in particular has been insane, and it's time to end it and replace it with a sensible regulatory system.
And Jason, do you want to add to that? And we're almost out of time, so also give us your final thoughts on where you think this is going.
Well, I think it's new ideas, new understanding, science-based understanding of marijuana has entered the public consciousness at a level never seen before. So the issue saliency is really high. People are reconsidering the war on drugs, which I agree with Norm, is a complete failure for the past 40 or so years. And two, the collateral crimes that prohibition causes need to be replaced with more, again, factually based policy.
And Mason, final thoughts from you?
We're clearly seeing a very rapid shift in public attitude here, and I think that occurs as there's more discussion. So I would simply say that I think we're going to continue to see this happening as long as there is public discussion, as long as there are programs like this addressing the subject. And I encourage people to bring up the subject with friends and family, whether they support it or not, and have that discussion, because what we find is that when people do that, they tend to come out on the right side of history and understand that marijuana prohibition is a failure and that these types of initiatives and legislation are the right way to go for this country.
Well, and there's a documentary called The House I Live In about these issues getting wide acclaim, so you might want to check that out. And also, we will definitely do another discussion about the health effects of marijuana, because we are getting a ton of emails about how this especially will affect children. And so we'll definitely continue this conversation. Jason Plume is a member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle, Washington. Mason Tvert, co-directed the successful campaign in support of Amendment 64 in Colorado. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Thanks for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation about coverage of Army Private Bradley Manning's whistleblower case. We'll also discuss a McClatchy investigation into the federal government's growing use of polygraph screenings, and we'll talk about the political crisis in Egypt. We'll be joined by McClatchy's Marissa Taylor, Fire Dog Lake's Kevin Gostola, and Al Jazeera's Shireen Tadros. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.